You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio. With me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. We're looking at what makes us human today, really. Who we are, that's what we're studying. Our studio guest is Dr. Giles Yeo. He's talking about his book, Gene Eating, which examines the role our genetics play in determining our weight. So that's the body. We'll also be addressing the psyche with Ruth Fox. She's a former Cambridge United player. She talks about battling depression, as chronicled in her memoir Within the White Lines, and love. Where would we be without love? Local historian Roger Lilly, he'll talk about the love story he uncovered on the back of a series of French World War I postcards. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark, Giles.
Hello, Lee. Thank you so much for having me on.
Lovely to have you here. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But well, you're a geneticist. Mm-hmm. Was it always going to be genetics that you were going to study?
I mean, I did genetics as an undergrad. I actually wanted to become a doctor, like a medical doctor. But then I spent a summer here in Cambridge in a lab here, as a lot of undergrads do, and in a genetics lab. And then what happened was at the end of the summer, my supervisor then asked me, did I want to do a PhD in molecular genetics? And I said yes. And so I put all my medical school applications into the bin. And I did my PhD in genetics. So that's how I actually turned from just studying genetics to then specializing in it.
And what was it about genetics that intrigued you?
You know, I've always been interested in what makes us the same and what makes us different. I've always had, I mean, you know, I happen to be Chinese by ethnicity, you know, and I happen to be bald. So I was always interested in why I was always interested in, you know, where would that have come from my side of the family, from, you know, was it from my mom's side, my dad's side? So I was just an interest in understanding what makes us the same and what makes us different that really got my interest in genetics.
And why the genetics of obesity?
That was actually serendipitous. I actually did my PhD of all things on the genetics of the Japanese pufferfish, fugu. Yeah, I know, exactly. And so it's fine. I was very well trained. I did.
We probably won't be covering that.
We won't
show.
Be. Well, what I actually realized as I was coming out was while I was well trained, that genetics of pufferfish was not going to pay my mortgage, was not going to get me a job. And so I ended up in obesity because there happened to be a lab close by. I went knocking on, you know, like Oliver Twist, I went knocking on the door. And at the time, there was a real boom in studying the genetics of body weight regulation, of severe obesity. And a major discovery had just been made. I knocked on a door. They needed a geneticist. And so I entered obesity. And this was probably 21 years ago now. And so serendipitous. But then I got in. I really enjoyed it. And I went from studying severe obesity, which I still has interest to me, to common obesity, to what makes us just a few pounds heavier, a few pounds lighter, what actually influences our normal distribution of body weight, and now to studying how our brain controls food intake.
So that's 21 years studying genetics. Mm. How do you see people? Do you see them as a bundle of genes? You know, when you see someone, do you instantly think, oh, look, you know, they've got a recessive blue-eyed gene or a dominant red-haired gene?
You see?
Can you now, switch off?
No, but isn't that the fun? So, you know, if you catch the 5 a.m. Stansted flight from somewhere to somewhere, you know, which I often do, and you're sat there with your one pint of coffee, right? And I do people watch. And in particular, I mean, because of what I do, I look at people's shape. Now, I don't do this in any judgmental fashion whatsoever. But if you think about it, if you actually look at the silhouettes of people, okay, and families wandering around, and you begin to say, "Ooh, does that the son match the father or the mother?" You begin to realize how much of a role genetics plays in our body shape and in our body size.
And a side question, because there's nowhere else in the show I can fit this question in: is it true that you were named from the hospital that you were born in?
It is true. While I was raised in California, so to speak, my dad was doing his specialty training. My dad is a doctor. He specializes in diabetes. Retired now. At King's College London, okay, the Lambeth campus, and so I popped out in King's College, but the day that I came out, there was a power outage, I think, in the nursery. Okay, so they had to put all the babies into a basket. I'm imagining what it was like. And they rolled us across the road, and there was a small hospital opposite, now since closed, called St. Giles Hospital. So in lieu of calling me King Yo, which would have given me all kinds of problems, my dad called me Giles Yo. So yes, it was not where I was born, but where, because of the power outage, all the babies were moved to temporarily.
Oh, what a fantastic story. Mm. Well, we'll start with your first choice of music. Mm-hmm. Now, Giles, is music important to you?
It is very important to me. So I happen, you know, as a hobby, I actually am a singer, so I do like to sing. And so I've picked my songs, I've picked a reflect, shall we say, what I've done singing. And this reflects my undergraduate career in terms of when I was there, I did a lot of a cappella singing. And this is one of the songs that we sang.
This is A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square by Manhattan Transfer. How lovely. A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square, my Manhattan Transfer. The first choice of music on Bookmark today from our studio guest, Giles Yeo. Giles has over 20 years' experience researching the genetics of obesity. His current research focuses on understanding how the key pathways in the brain, which control food intake, differ from person to person and how our genes influence our eating habits. He's Director of Genomics at the MRC Metabolic Diseases Unit and a Fellow of Wolfson College, Cambridge. He's also presented various BBC TV programmes, including Trust Me, I'm a Doctor and an Horizon special, Clean Eating, The Dirty Truth. Gene Eating, The Science of Obesity and the Truth About Diets is his first book. Dr. Michael Mosley described it as informative and entertaining. Giles not only delves into the science of obesity, he says, but with honesty and great precision, skewers many of the more foolish fad diets. Well, a word that kept coming up when I was writing that introduction, mm-hmm. Giles, and actually in other interviews that I read with you, honesty and truth. They're very important to you, aren't they? That people receive truthful information and can make an honest decision based on that.
I mean, I think clearly honesty and truth have always been important, I hope, okay, to most of us. But I think it takes a particular resonance, shall we say, in today's world, in today's post-truth world. How is that a thing? How did post-truth suddenly become a thing? And where there is a huge distrust of experts of all shades of color, you know, including scientists. And clearly I focus on obesity and I focus on diets within the scenario. And so, but more broadly, I am interested in getting the truth out. And I do think that as an expert in my own tiny little field, okay, I do have a duty to tell the truth, warts and all, to people so they can actually see what science is like, what academics is like, and to actually make their own decisions about the kind of health and food decisions they want to make.
And this world of diets is full of claims and counterclaims, isn't it? I mean, it's a quagmire of what is the truth and what is not.
So a couple of things. I mean, people always complain that, shall we say, experts disagree with each other. We always change our mind. And the problem is we are paid to change our mind and we're paid to argue with each other as experts. You know, new evidence emerges and yes, we will change our mind. And so I think that is part of the issue where a lot of people do not understand how science works. Okay, and so there is that. And so there's a lot of other people, non-experts, who say, look, these people don't understand what they're talking about. Listen to me. And this is important, particularly today, because I think of the proliferation of social media. Now, I'm a social media user, but it has good and bad sides, as with everything. But social media has democratized journalism. okay, in very many ways, where unlike someone having an editor to answer to, you can now set up a blog, you can set up anything, post it online. And if you are wanting, say you need to lose weight and you're looking online to say, oh, what's the best approach of losing weight? What ends up happening is you get a deluge. If you put that, I mean, a deluge, millions of hundreds of millions of web pages. What do you believe is true and what don't you believe is true? And so I'm hoping in my own little tiny itsy bitsy teeny weeny way, you know, to provide a little bit of truth so that people can find some truth out there at least.
And it's been described as an anti-diet book. Are you happy with that description? I mean, how would you describe this book?
I do think it's an anti-diet book because the problem is the moment you say diet book, people think there is a plan, you know, a six-step plan, you know, in which I guarantee you lose weight as long as you follow this. Okay, and even have merchandise, okay, in order for that. Whereas I just don't think there is a magical plan. I think there are ways and strategies of which people can use to lose weight, right? But they're going to be individualized. And so this is an anti-diet book because it's a book about the diets that are out there rather than me trying to sell a diet per se. That's why I call it an anti-diet book.
And I said it's your first book. I mean, undoubtedly, you've had other things published in terms of a medical capacity and a professional capacity. Mm-hmm. This is clearly aimed at a mass audience, mm-hmm. a public audience. Was that quite challenging?
It was interesting. Shall we say, you're right, I write for a living and I have written for a living in terms of papers and grants and blah, blah, blah. Okay, dry stuff, I would say. And this is my first popular science book. What the biggest challenge for me was to actually work out the correct rate of delivery of facts. So in other words, the number of facts to deliver per page almost. And I relied on my... on the publisher and the editor, actually, to say, too dense. So I started off, as you might imagine, too dense. I was giving too much information packed together without letting each of the facts breathe. And so once I actually found the right rate of delivery of facts and make sure that the stuff I delivered in between the facts was interesting to read, then the writing came easier.
And I suppose there's jargon, there's acronyms, mm-hmm. there's things that you're used to that mm-hmm. a general reader wouldn't know.
That's right. And that is very important, okay, because people within my field often say, oh, yeah, you know, we're dumbing down the language, dumbing down the language. I hate that term. I hate the term dumbing down, removing the jargon, because it immediately assumes that you are dumber than me. I am less dumb than you. It's there is a judgment there. Whereas all I think we need to do as we change audiences, as I'm doing here, is to just mind your language in terms of what we use. For example, I'm going to give you one example. Okay, the word expression. Okay, now I say the word expression and everybody listening now will understand the word, but depending on who you are, to different capacity. If I say the word expression to a scientist, okay, they'll ask me, are you talking about expression of a gene or expression of a protein? Immediately. They're not going to assume, is it my facial expression? Whereas if I speak to you and I say expression, a sad expression? Are you talking about an expression of an English language? So classically, that is the same word, but to...
It's all right. It happens every time.
Oh, okay. I thought it was a fire alarm. But you know, when actually people can use exactly the same word but mean different things. And so I think that was the other challenge with writing this book, is to make sure that even a simple word like expression, I made sure that I used it appropriately, or if I used it within a jargon setting, I explained it.
And it's a timely book, isn't it? I mean, you say in the introduction, has there ever been a time in history when there have been so many dietary options? Yet this is not necessarily a good thing. People are looking for this silver bullet that might not exist.
People are looking for the silver bullet. And every year, and unfortunately every year from now as well, there is always going to be a new year, new you, new me type of diet that is out there. In many ways, what I'm hoping to have done with this book is to actually introduce some, shall we say, some universal truths, some facts in which you can actually pick apart a new fad diet and ask, does it have any basis in truth at all? Because most of the diets out there work to some degree in a short term. And I'm just trying to find out how they work, okay, are they based in no scientific fact at all? And hopefully I'm giving some information so you can take the newest diet, say in 2020 when some other diet comes out, you know, can you actually look at it, pick it apart and say, this is complete BS, or this is a diet that maybe could work for me and my lifestyle, and I should give it a go.
And we're about to hear from Ruth Fox, who'll be talking about her battle with depression. Mm. And that's a reason why this is important, isn't it? Because people's self-image, there's a lot of fat shaming going on. This industry, it's not about the body, it's also about the mind.
It's hugely about the mind. And the problem is, you know, while depression in and of itself has clearly always been out there and always been a thing, the concept of social media, particularly the concept of beautiful images being sold to and linking it to food, okay, because all of us eat, all right, and all of us. And while you cannot control things like your depression very well, I'm not a psychologist by any means, but I don't think it's something you can think away or pull yourself together. What people find is that they can use food as a proxy to control it. And this is part of the problem, right? Because while you can't control depression, you can control your food. And that is where a lot of situations, disordered eating actually comes about. So actually, if you begin to judge people by what they look like and judge people by what they eat, then a subpopulation of the people who are susceptible will begin to actually use the food in a disordered fashion. And I think that's incredibly unhealthy.
Thank you, Giles. We'll be coming back to you in just a moment. Let's hear from Ruth now. Growing up, Ruth Fox was on track for an ideal life. She had the grades, friends, a strong bond with her sister and a budding career in football playing for Cambridge United. But at 14, she was diagnosed with depression. Within the White Lines chronicles Ruth's battle over the next few years with mental illness. When finding herself let down repeatedly by authorities, she sought support and understanding from role models and discovered the healing power of sport. She's now an ambassador and advisor for the Shaw Mind Foundation and Mental Health FA. Dame Kelly Holmes said of Within the White Lines, "This book gives insight to a young life torn between wanting to be happy and successful and the demons that can affect anyone's well-being." And Stan Collymore said, "Ruth is an inspiration. She's going to help a lot of people with this book. Honest, insightful and candid." I met Ruth at Abbey Stadium, the home of Cambridge United, and she agreed that the ground had played an important part in her road to recovery.
Yeah, I guess particularly over the last 12 months and beyond, I guess, as a release, I guess, for me. The title of the book is Within the White Lines, and for me, during, I guess, the most difficult periods of my life, on the football pitch was the only place that I could have a bit of an escapism.
Was that what it was when you were playing football? You were forgetting everything else, you were living in the moment?
Yeah, absolutely, and I think you couldn't really afford to switch off and think about anything else. So yeah, I think there's a lot of things that came alongside that, not only the playing but the social side of it, where when during the day potentially, you know, things were difficult to even escape from your room sometimes, knowing that there's a group of people there to be a safety net, I think was important, and also a place that you could be you. And when I was struggling a lot, the depression took over and took away a lot of parts of me that made me me, and it was a place that I could reach my full potential where other parts of my life I couldn't at all.
And you used the word depression there. When did you become first aware of the word depression as something to describe how you were feeling?
Well, the moment I was diagnosed when I was 14 is the first time I ever heard of the word, to be honest. Yeah, it was something that I would never have associated with me, ever, let alone it completely encompassed my life and turned into something that I still have to manage on a day-to-day basis. Yeah, so I got diagnosed when I was 14. I think I was in year 9 at school, and my sister just moved to university, so I kind of suddenly didn't have my best friend beside me 24/7. It's something I always knew would happen, but for some reason I just didn't deal with it very well, emotionally kind of detached from her, and I really hated being the centre of attention at home and suddenly became an only child, which I just didn't deal with very well. It really made me aware of what mental illness and mental health were, and if I hadn't have gone for it at that young age, then I feel like I wouldn't have the level of empathy that I do now as to what other people potentially could be going through.
That does seem very young, and there are some people who think that you can't be depressed when you're that age. That's just part of the ups and downs of being a teenager.
And I would disagree. I think 60% of mental illnesses develop before a child is 14, so it's not unusual. I think there are a lot of pressures facing young people, and it's important to mention, yeah, there are a whole host of changes that you go through, whether that be physical changes, but also emotional changes, moving schools, GCSEs, things like that, which of course everybody has to deal with, and having a bad day doesn't mean that you're suddenly diagnosed with a mental illness, but mental illnesses can affect anyone and everyone. And the place that I was in, you know, where I couldn't escape from my room, where I was crying for days on end, was the complete opposite to what I'd been like ever before. And it was such a confusing and isolating kind of place to be. It was almost a bit of a relief to have a, I guess, a label for it, so I could put it down to something.
You're very blunt in your book about the failure of authorities to help you.
It was incredibly frustrating. For me, I try and be as honest as I possibly can, and I wouldn't be 100% honest if I didn't mention the letdowns that I experienced, because it won't just be me that experiences them. But I think especially if you're a vulnerable young person and you're being dropped off lists, people aren't calling you. And also when things are beyond your control, so you move counties or you turn 18, these are things that you can't control. And when that means suddenly all of your care and treatment is stopped, it's incredibly difficult and isolating. And I'm always honest with the impact that had on me and the repercussions that that meant for, you know, my own life. And I am, because, you know, I aspire to try and change some of that and to stop people from going through what I've been through in that sense. When you're in a vulnerable place and you're asking for help and you recognise you need help, which both take an enormous amount of courage, the help needs to be there to support you and to guide you through that most difficult period of your life. And when it's not there, of course, it's incredibly frustrating. And yeah, I just truly hope that things change quickly, definitely.
A lot of courage, yes, to do all those things. A lot of courage to write the book as well. How was it reliving all those emotions and those times for you?
Something I never thought I would do, let alone at 19. I think the actual writing process was, you know, an enormous part of my own recovery, and having to kind of relive it was, in the moment, not that difficult when I was writing it. And it was interesting and good, I guess, to explore some parts of my life that I'd not really delved into. The most difficult bit has been when I finished the book. I finished it in June and it actually got published in November. It's that moment that it's now released to the public, and anyone in the country could buy it. Anyone probably globally can buy it. And for me, that was the most scary bit and the most difficult bit. And that's when I started to relive some of the emotions and things, which surprise me. But with all of the work that I do now, I just aspire to help somebody. And I've almost written a book that I wish I'd read when I was struggling, and it's a story of hope. And that's, you know, what I want to give to someone, is just that thread of hope, because sometimes that's all it takes.
Yeah, you are really putting yourself out there. As you say, anybody around the world can find out about you, reveal quite personal things in it.
The things I've been through are not kind of unusual. Mental health is becoming ever more in the public eye. But that doesn't mean that there aren't people still struggling in silence, and I don't expect people to write books or speak in front of people or do media stuff to have a voice. I aspire to be a voice for those people. I didn't have a voice for 3 years of my life, and I felt so lost, and I just want to give people that hope that things can get better, but also, I guess, share with people my ongoing journey and how I get by day to day, because I just want to be totally honest with people.
And we're at Cambridge United Football Club. Do you think it's harder for sportsmen and women to admit that they're vulnerable?
Sports people are particularly prone to developing mental illnesses because there is a huge amount of pressure on them. I think men in particular struggle to talk about their emotions. And again, something that obviously as a society, trying to allow men the space and opportunity to be able to talk about how they feel and not come across as weak, because it takes a lot more strength to actually open up about how you're feeling. But yeah, I think particularly, you know, at a high level, you're in the public eye a lot, and sharing vulnerabilities is seen as a weakness and always has. And changing rooms are very macho, manly places. On the reverse side, there are well-known sports people who have opened up about their own mental health struggles. The majority of people see that as very strong and see that takes a lot of courage. I've been lucky enough to meet a couple of them. Leon McKenzie wrote the foreword to my book, and what's brilliant is people opening up after they've finished playing and when they've retired, but obviously whilst they're playing. I think that to allow people in to get their perspective of life and what it's like and the pressure that people are under, in particular where sports are very results-based jobs, aren't they? And if you're not performing, people just, you know, instantly are on you. But I always say to people, footballers, students, whoever they are, they're people first and foremost. And that's a message I try and get across, is people need emotional support before anything. And sometimes, you know, if a player is out of form or just not playing well, maybe there's a reason. Instead of instantly thinking, well, they're just terrible, how about we strip it back and actually think about what's going on for that person? And I think we're very quick to judge society. Sometimes we just need to take a step back and think, what's actually going on and how does that person feel? That's a really, really valuable thing.
And there's lots in your book. Is there one takeaway message that you'd like people to take if they read it? One thing that you really want them to go away with?
There's probably a couple. I couldn't really pinpoint one. I think the first thing is, like, it's okay to struggle, and we all do, and life is made up of ups and downs, and it's the downs that we, like, learn the most about ourselves and grow the most. I guess one message that I put across is health and happiness comes first before anything else. And for me, particularly looking at it from a student, young person, teacher point of view, I was a straight A student and I didn't finish my A-levels, didn't go to uni, did go to uni, dropped out of uni. We learn for a living, and, like, I don't have an English A-level and I've written a book. Our impact on society, on the community is far more impactful and far more successful than getting straight A's or being in a very high-end job. Obviously, my aspiration is to get mental and physical health on the same level, and just to know that people who are struggling, they're not alone, and things do always get better.
You seem very mature. Has this whole experience made you that way, do you think?
I don't know. I think you have to grow up quickly. When life throws stuff at you, I've had to gain quite a lot of self-awareness over the last 12 months in particular, where there's been a lack of professional support in my own life. I've had to gain an understanding of what works for me, what I'm able to deal with and what I'm not, and what my purpose now is. I think everyone goes through difficult, dark periods in their life, and I've gone through it quite early. I might go through it again, and that's okay, but I've just learned, I guess, a lot from it and gained an awful lot of awareness, perspective, whatever you might call it, that maybe potentially people go through later on. But you get so caught up in the whole school, university, job whirlwind that I obviously thought I would go in as well, that you kind of never take a moment to stop and have a look at the bigger picture. Only when you're on the edge and moments away from taking your own life, that's when you kind of gain that perspective. When you've gotten through that, you're able to look back and try and grow and develop every day.
And what now for you then? You've written the book, you're publicising that. What else are you doing at the moment?
I have taken it upon myself to try and speak with a lot of young people. I always pretend I'm speaking to a younger me who never heard of mental health before, struggling with it. So I go across the country sharing my story with teachers or students, with mental health professionals. I've done a few interviews as well along the way. I do a bit of work with county FAs as well, looking at the football side of things. I also work with the national FA to develop a mental health strategy, following on from a campaign that I recently launched. I guess the three key areas I particularly want to work on are the education system, mental health system, and football. I realise I can't change all of those, but I can try and make a small impact on each of them. For me, in my own journey and where I am now, the gaps that I've seen within my own support network, majority of them through the mental health services, but also potentially in school and things like that, what can I be doing to fill those gaps for somebody else? Any opportunities that come about, kind of try and take as many as I can, ride the wave that, yeah, has somehow came about, yeah.
A remarkable young woman. Within the White Lines by Ruth Fox is published by Trigger. Listening to that with me was Dr. Giles Yeo, our studio guest today on Bookmark, talking about his book, Gene Eating. Strong words from Ruth there.
They're very strong words. And she does sound incredibly mature for a 19-year-old, I have to say. When I was 19 years old, I didn't know what was left and what was right. And I think she's highlighted some points which are very, very important, where we don't understand how people feel, okay? I mean, because we understand ourselves, we feel what we feel. So if someone else is feeling down and someone else is feeling, buck up. Just pull yourself together. You know, life is okay. You have money, or you're privileged, or you may not be, but yet you can be depressed. I do see a lot of parallels, I have to say, with the obesity problem, because people often say to people, just eat less, just move more, and then you'll lose the weight. But we don't understand why this person became obese. Let me stop there. We probably do. They probably ate too much. They probably moved too little. Why did they eat too much? Were they eating more because they were depressed? Were they eating more because they felt hungrier? Were they eating more for a host of different reasons? And so, I mean, very much like depression, we need to look at body weight and body shape and body size as something which is individual. And the way people got there all differ. You know, someone has something all the time. So we shouldn't judge someone's size, even if the way to lose weight is to eat less and to move more. We have to understand why people eat more, understanding that is going to play an important role in terms of solving the obesity problem.
Well, thank you, Giles. Let's hear some music for a moment. Your second choice is Stevie Wonder and Superstitious. Why this one?
So I for the past 20 years, I've sung in a band, a covers band called Casa del Funk in Cambridge. And we do disco funk, which is, I know slightly, given that fact that I'm a bald Chinese guy singing disco funk, I don't know, but this this is one of the songs that we sing.
Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark, and our studio guest on Bookmark today is Dr. Giles Yeo, talking about his book, Gene Eating. I suppose the big question, the million-dollar question, Giles, is can we escape our genetics in terms of weight loss and our relationship with food?
Oh, my goodness.
I know, that's the one, isn't it?
It is. I mean, clearly our genes influence who we are, everything about who we are, okay? And so there's a genetic element to every single one of our traits. You know, how quickly our fingernails grow, why I'm bald, our body weight, even actually rate of car accidents. But we'll leave that alone. The question is, how much of it is your genes and how much of it is your environment? And so while I study the genetic variability of why people are fat, thin or average size in this environment, I think a big part of solving the problem will also be to try and fix the environment. Why I'm interested in the genes is because if we can understand more about how we react to food within the environment, some people like sweet food, some people like fatty food, some people eat because they're stressed, other people eat because stop eating when they're stressed. If we can understand a bit more about that, which will have a genetic impact, we can then have a better way of actually personalizing a diet for you or for someone else if that person needs to lose weight. So people always accuse me of giving people of giving overweight people, obese people, and I use those terms non-pejoratively, an excuse because I'm studying their genes. I'm not. I'm trying to understand what has contributed to how they've got to where they've got, and can knowing that information help them get to where they want to be, thinner, healthier, whatever. So that's the way I look at it.
Could you give a moderate thumbs up to some diets? The intermittent fasting gets a moderate thumbs up from you. The increase in protein, fibre diet, gluten-free. Have you got little ticks beside those?
I mean, where I come from is that a lot of these diets have a kernel of truth to them, but at some point fantasy has emerged. So gluten-free, for example, I'll handle that because that's hugely popular at the moment. If you're celiac, which means you're allergic to gluten, and that's 1% of the population, do stay away from it. There are 4% or so of people who are gluten intolerant, and it's probably not a good idea, you know. But 25% of us buy gluten-free. Why? Because if you actually, particularly in the West, if you give up gluten, invariably you're giving up a lot of your carbohydrates because that's going to be present in wheat, present in barley. And so you end up going on a low carb diet invariably, okay, which means you got to replace the carb with something else, and people replace it with protein. And so protein makes you feel fuller because it takes longer to digest. If you feel fuller, you eat less, you lose weight. So gluten-free is a useful strategy for people to lose weight, for some people to lose weight, just not for the reasons that people say.
Right. Glad we cleared that up.
Just want to point it out. Sorry.
No, absolutely. Well, let's take a sort of sidestep now. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about love. Roger Lilly is a local historian and editor for the Museum of Cambridge, the Capturing Cambridge Project. He recently uncovered a postcard exchange between a husband and wife during World War One, which he's published, translated and with a commentary under the title Petite Poste de Coeur. When I met Roger, I started by asking him when his interest in postcards first began.
I mean, I suppose it was about 6 or 7 years ago when I was doing family history research, and I discovered my wife was remotely related to an Edwardian actress, and I managed to find pictures of her on postcards. Then I thought it'd be quite interesting to see if I could find postcard pictures of the places where our family members lived 100 years ago. My family grew up in Southend-on-Sea, and I found some pictures of the old tram lines which had disappeared before I was born. And in the process, discovered there was a whole world of collectible postcards out there accessible through eBay. And at the same time, my interests, I was doing research in the First World War for St John the Evangelist Church, and discovered there was a lot of material available in the way of First World War postcards, and particularly the French postcards were extraordinarily beautiful. So I just sort of started to dabble and buy up batches of these in eBay. And it was through doing that that by chance I bought from some dealer in France, at, you know, just for a few pounds, a collection which turned out to be the complete correspondence of a couple in southern France who basically more or less wrote a postcard to each other every day, you know, during the First World War. However, I didn't quite understand the significance of this because my French is not particularly fluent, certainly not when it comes to reading handwriting. But a friend of mine said she was interested in a French friend, interested in translating them. It was only then we realised, you know, quite how vivid and descriptive these postcards were.
And when you say postcards, we're talking about postcards that at present day we would recognise as postcards.
Oh, yeah, we certainly recognise them. But, of course, back in the time of the First World War, that was the form of communication. I mean, people didn't really have access to phones, certainly not ordinary working class people. And they didn't have Twitter accounts and email. So if you wanted to get a message to someone quickly, you know, you would send a postcard. And quite often, I mean, say in Cambridge here before the First World War, if you posted a postcard in the morning, it was with someone by the afternoon. Now, there were several deliveries a day. So that really was the way of getting, you know, a message to someone quickly.
And this is correspondence between a couple, Camille and Léa Dessay.
Yeah, yeah.
For 4 years while he's away at the front fighting.
Yeah, well, in fact, it covers a longer period than that. I mean, he was already in the military service in France and had served in Algeria before the First World War. But, you know, when war came in 1914, you know, he was called up from the reserves and he basically served right through to 1919. I mean, he probably saw service at the front in active service initially, but in one of the postcards, you can feel Leia's great relief when she finds that he's actually been transferred away from the front line to work as a cook for the officers' mess. She thinks this is hilarious because quite obviously he doesn't cook at home. And so she's looking forward to finding out what, you know, what his cooking is like when he eventually comes home. But clearly it was, you know, it was a much safer place to be, and also a place which meant he could get access to food, more food, better food, which meant that she didn't have to send in money to supplement, you know, his diet. So it meant that she was better off because he was now working in a cookhouse.
So reading the correspondence between these two people, you build up a real picture of who they are and their relationship, their ups and downs.
Yeah, no, I think you do, and this is what's so, so remarkable about it, you know, that she writes in great detail about how difficult it is for her at home, not just the cold, not just her daughter's illness, but what she's doing in their farm. They must run a small farm. 1 week she has to dig up the potatoes. At the beginning of the war, she has to go and claim some of the state benefits which the French government made available to people to help them through, because they realised that was going to be really tough on those left at home. But then she, you know, she gets angry because, you know, she can see that one of her neighbours, whom she's sure is better off than she is also, you know, claiming these benefits. You get a real idea of the tensions and issues that were being brought up at home, let alone at the front.
And even though these are postcards, so they're open to anybody who wants to read them, these are quite intense and personal emotions that are expressed here.
Oh, well, absolutely, and this is what's so remarkable. I mean, it does seem to be the case, because I've collected quite a lot of British postcards from the period. The English weren't quite so good at expressing themselves, whether this was something to do with censorship or not, but you very rarely come across a vivid, densely packed postcard, you know, written back to the UK from soldiers at the front. But the French soldiers and the French wives crammed every single word they possibly could onto the back of their postcards. So, you know, when you've actually deciphered them, they make quite gripping reading.
And didn't the French Postal Service actually go into meltdown because so many...
Well, yeah, because basically the whole of the French nation was at war right from the start, 1914. It was a much bigger operation than initially in the UK. So the French government foresaw there were going to be major problems with families keeping together and keeping their relationships going. So very early on, they introduced free postage. And so suddenly the French post office was completely overwhelmed with vast millions and millions of postcards, flying to and from the front. But of course, it maintained a fantastic business for postcard manufacturers and sellers. And there's some extraordinarily beautiful designs, very elaborate photo montage scenes that they put together using professional models. It's quite interesting that these postcards were so attractive that you find them being bought up by English soldiers and sent home as well. So that the French really led the way in beautifully produced and mass-produced postcards.
Yeah, some of these images on the front, they're very beautiful, and some are quite erotic.
Yeah, sure. I think the French government realised that they had to keep passions burning between couples, and there was a real danger of a sort of meltdown in family life. They were particularly concerned about childbirth and the fact that there would be a dip in the population. And so they didn't keep much secret of the fact that they wanted to keep the population growth going. And there are some very strange postcards, strange to us nowadays, of what we can translate as baby farms. Now, the French government saw the need for babies, new babies, as really important because the babies were the workforce and also the soldiers of the future.
And how did it feel to you? Because you're reading these quite personal exchanges between a married couple. How does that feel?
It gives you an insight into clearly what was a difficult and traumatic period in most people's lives. I mean, we've heard an awful lot about the First World War in the last 4 years, and we've had little bits of insight, but it's rare that you get this kind of view into the raw emotions between a married couple. I think it's sad, really, that this clearly was a collection of postcards that had probably been taken from a house when it was being cleared, ended up in the hands of a dealer, probably much more because of belief that the appearance of the front of the postcards was what would make them collectible. Whereas, in fact, it's what's on the back that really makes them valuable, because it's only on the back you get these personal views of individuals.
How does it feel reading those? Do you feel a bit nosy or voyeuristic?
No, I don't think so. Now, I think if one discovered a collection like that in your own family, of correspondence between your own great-grandparents, you'd be absolutely fascinated. And it brings people alive. And it's quite interesting that for many, many years, this kind of social history behind the First World War was neglected, really, because there weren't that many collections of correspondence, certainly not between ordinary people. The correspondence that survived tend to be between better educated people. But French social history researchers have become aware of the importance of telling the story of ordinary people's lives. But unfortunately, 100 years on, the evidence for this has vanished beginning to disappear because it's got lost. It's got lost in people's attics and it's been cleared out. But you can still discover it. I was in Rouen in the autumn and there are still postcard dealers there. And when I look through boxes of postcards, I'm not so much looking at the pictures on the front. I'm looking at the back, because if I can find a group of postcards which clearly are in the same hand and from the same person, then they're much more likely to have a narrative behind them than just the odd one.
Do we know what happened to them? Do we know what happened to Camille and Leigh?
Well, Natalie and I have been in contact with the mayor of this small town in the south of France. We know that Leah sadly died a few years after the First World War and Camille married again. But we really don't know much more about the family after that. We can only assume that, as happens with some families, the family sort of line petered out. And that's why these postcards got lost. Sometimes it is possible to return things to families. I did that quite recently. I went back to France with an old embroidered fire screen and actually returned it to the grandchildren of the lady who'd made it in the 19th century, and they were thrilled.
So what next for you then, Roger?
I go where the evidence takes me. I mean, at the moment, I've done a lot of work on the Newtown area of Cambridge. What we're doing on the Capturing Cambridge project is like having a big jigsaw where we're putting the pieces in. And sometimes the pieces are more interesting than others. Sometimes a piece which represents a house, we have a photo to go with it. Sometimes we have an interview. The opposite side of the coin is where you have an incredibly vivid correspondence like these postcards, but it's isolated. So, what I'm hoping over the next few years is that people will come forward and we can start building up this picture of Newtown and other parts of Cambridge with people's reminiscences, with people's photos, with interviews, and try and capture before it's lost some of the information about people's lives in different parts of Cambridge.
That was Roger Lilly there, and you can find out more about Camille and Laird Isere, their published collection of their postcards, by emailing Roger. If you email him at Holbrook, H-O-L-B-R-O-O-K, at ntlworld.com. Well, we're coming, I'm afraid, to the end of our time with you, Giles Joe. We've been talking to you today about your book Gene Eating, which is published by Orion Books. What next for you?
Ooh, I mean, I'm still carrying on my actual day job, obviously, in terms of still trying to understand how the brain controls food intake, understanding more of the details, more of the circuitry behind that. I'm filming season 9 of Trust Me, I'm a Doctor. And maybe there's a second book rattling around my head somewhere.
And normally the only B word I allow on this show is books, but I will make an exception in this case. Yes, you know where I'm going with this. How will Brexit affect your work? Will it affect your work?
It will, because as an academic here in Cambridge, we rely, I would like to think that certainly science is one of the very, very few truly colorblind, nation-blind industries there. I only care about how good the scientist is, and we need freedom of movement. And so the lack of freedom of movement is going to severely hamper our ability to recruit the best scientists to do the job we need them to do.
And professionally, what's your own research aim? If I could speed ahead and awarding you a Nobel Prize for something, what would you like to have the prize awarded for?
I think I'd like to play a role in actually understanding a lot more about why different people behave differently around food. And I know that's what I'm doing now, but we know so little about it. And that is what I would like to continue doing.
And the question that we ask all our guests on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment? What's on your bedside table?
I've got two books, actually. I've got a book called Homo Deus by the author of Sapiens. Oh, my God, I forgot his name now. I forgot his name. It's awful.
I'm going to help you, I'm afraid.
No, it's Homo Deus, and that's my non-fiction book. And I happen to be a science fiction nut, and so I'm reading a book by Kim Stanley Robinson. He wrote the Mars trilogy, but this is about New York in the 23rd century or something like that. I know, ridiculous. Don't judge me.
Fantastic. Well, lovely talking to you today. We're going to come back to you in a moment to hear your final piece of music, Giles. But I would say if you are interested in food and eating, and who's not, then tune into Flavour, our fortnightly show here on Cambridge 105 Radio, which is dedicated to food and drink. You can listen online and listen to old shows on our website, cambridge105.co.uk. On our next show, studio guest is Cambridge crime writer Kate Rhodes. She'll be talking about her latest book, Hell Bay. We'll also hear from children and YA novelist Julia Golding, and Carol Carman will be talking to me about her fantasy novel, Gingerbread Children. But we'll sign out now, Giles, with your last choice of music, which is Merry-Go-Round by Kacey Musgraves. Why this one?
Oh, because if I had to choose the kind of music I'd like to sing now, although there's no demand for bald Chinese people doing this, is country music. And I like Kacey Musgraves because she actually observes. It's not bro country. It's actually intelligent country music.
If you ain't got two kids by 21, you're probably gone. That's what tradition told you.